Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. You can't understand the South without trying to understand Charleston. Tourists know it for the pretty houses and five-star restaurants. Some white Southerners revere the Citadel and the Civil War sites. But for Black Americans, Charleston is Ellis Island rewritten as a horror story. It's the primary port through which slaves came into this country. Now, on a wharf in Charleston Harbor, the International African American Museum is rising to tell that story. It's scheduled to open in 2022, and Elijah Hayward III, a son of that South Carolina coast, is the museum's chief operating officer. In some ways, it's a job he's prepared for his whole life. Here's our conversation. You are the chief operating officer of a history museum. But in the moment this year, the summer especially, it feels like there's some African American history that is actually happening. That this seems to be a moment that we could look back on as being historically important. How do you think about that as somebody who's trying to put together a museum?
You know, our team is really committed to considering the past, but to your point, so much history is actually happening before our eyes this summer. Growing up, I was so inspired by the civil rights movement, by the activism, by the collaborative approach that people from all walks of life took to justice. And I wondered what it would be to live through a moment like that. And I'll say that this summer has given me the closest feel or proximity to that. And as an institution that is currently in the process of being built, one that will be opening in 2022, but is in its phase of a very rapid startup process, it's really, you know, challenges us to consider our role in a new way. You know, we are committed to preserving an important part of American history from an African-American perspective. But around us, we have history that's being made that points back to us as an origin point. So I would just say to directly answer your question, there's no way to really understand where we are as a nation without beginning in Charleston and looking at the root of many of the racial issues that really are captivating us in this moment.
So explain for people who might not know, explain why the site where y'all are building the museum might have particular importance.
Well, Charleston is an amazing city. I think that many people in our country and likely around the world see it as a tourist destination, a place of beauty, a place of great food, a place of natural offerings that really inspire you in particular ways. There's also this aesthetic that we've seen in movies and beyond about the South that Charleston really encapsulates in a particular way. What's suddenly not celebrated or acknowledged is the African-American presence in Charleston and history in Charleston. Charleston is the single greatest point of entry for African captives in America. So we argue nearly half of all enslaved Africans that came to America passed through Charleston before going to other points in the colonies. So that means that there's a way that African-American history points to Charleston in a really important way as what Professor Henry Louis Gates calls ground zero. So given the sheer number of African captives that were brought to Charleston, and given the fact that arguably every African American can trace one relative to Charleston as a point of entry, there's a way that there is a really important discourse around history, around culture, around African American identity that Charleston is at the center of. Beyond that, Charleston was the wealthiest city in the colonies for nearly a century. And the largest wharf in the colonies, Gaston's Wharf, is a site upon we're building the International African American Museum. So all these ways, that American history points back to Charleston in a way that we are privileging African-American identity. Beyond that, from our site, you can see Fort Sumter, where the Civil War started. You can see Sullivan's Island, the point of quarantine for slave ships who were taking the journey from West Africa. You have the Hampton Park, where David Blight argues was the site of the first Memorial Day, and cultural outputs such as music and spiritual practices, Gullah Geechee identity, foodways, all of the above that really make Charleston a very important case study and identity that we hope to share with the world through this institution that we're building.
You mentioned the Gullah Geechee culture of that coastal South Carolina, Georgia area. I'm from coastal Georgia, and I always heard it as Geechee, but I think probably the dividing line is Georgia to South Carolina, depending on how people speak of it. Could you sort of explain for folks who might not know sort of what that culture is and what it was like for you to grow up around it?
Sure. And where are you from exactly?
I'm from Brunswick, St. Simon's Island.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. I'm from Beaufort, South Carolina, so not terribly far away, but we're all a part of this coastal region that I think we can all, we share an appreciation for just the coast, the beauty, rivers, all of the above. And I'll say that that was the greatest gift of my childhood, growing up on the coast of South Carolina, being in the river with my father and grandfather, who taught me, you know, how to fish, how to crab, how to shrimp, really how to be sustained from the rivers in a way that points to the importance of Gullah Geechee identity. You know, the identity itself is distinct because the community that I come from, which spans from the tip of North Carolina to the tip of Florida, is likely the largest group of African Americans in the country who have sustained retentions of African identity by virtue of the isolation during the period of slavery on Barrier Island. And even beyond that, you know, there's a bridge to Coosaw Island in Beaufort, which is where my family is based in part. And that bridge was constructed in the 60s. So before then, you know, there were decades, you know, before then where, you know, families on the island, you know, had to either take a boat to get across to the mainland or a ferry, which means that there's a level of connection that was sustained, you know, of community that was built by virtue of that, you know, the one institution on the island. So it's just a really rich sense of community, of connection, of beauty that really informed so much of my childhood through spiritual practice, through food ways, through the way that family was formed through fictive kin, individuals who were not related, who were able to be bound by ideals of family because necessity, but also because of choice in a really constructive way. There's a great pride that I have in having Gullah Geechee identity. But for a while, it was a pejorative to be called Geechee or Gullah because of the ways in which the dialect or the practices were seen as being contrary to mainstream America or even Southern identity. But there's so much beauty through the artistic practices, the music, the worship, all these things that sustain me today through my life that I always appreciate. And I think among that is the blessing of being raised by elders. So, you know, the beauty is that I had an amazing childhood informed by both of my parents. But an extension of that was my community of my grandparents, aunts, uncles, community members from all walks of life who had a hand in raising me. You know, me and so many other youth embodied the adage, it takes a village to raise a child. There was no home I couldn't go into on Coosaw Island or Sands Point that where I wouldn't be fed, cared for, or embraced as family.
When you were growing up, did you know or did people in your family talk about the importance of Charleston and, you know, the history you referred to earlier about it being such an important place in the slave trade and that sort of?
No, unfortunately not. You know, my parents did a great job to supplement the education I received by, you know, really highlighting African-American achievement in our culture and history. You know, they're both activists and community leaders in their own right who were engaged at Penn Center and our church in various ways. So there's a very strong connection to identity, to history locally and beyond. But I don't think I really had an appreciation for, you know, Charleston's greater role. You know, I understood that Charleston was the start of the Civil War, and South Carolina being the first state to secede from the Union, and, you know, this greater history in the American landscape. But I don't think I fully understood the African-American connection to these narratives in this place. It's amazing also because every year our school took a trip to Charleston. We went to the Dock Street Theater to see a play, visited the Gibbs Art Museum, and I think we likely went to one of the parks. But even then, there's a sense of distance because the experience I had as a young person didn't really reflect my experience as an African American. You know, I tell the story sometimes about my great grandmother being the most important curator of my youth because she curated her home to reflect her identity, one as a Southern woman, one as a Christian woman, one as a Gullah Geechee native. But, you know, as a kid, I remember just going to her living room, as most kids do, and you have this display of family photos. So I recall looking on the wall for my picture because, you know, I have to be somewhere in this family arrangement of photos. And there's a sense of pride in finding your picture and then finding your parents' picture and your sister's picture and seeing reflections of yourself, this affirmation, this sense of connection, this sense of a bonding to a narrative that's greater than your own. And I think for me, one thing that really inspired my passion for museums and cultural institutions is representation. You know, I remember just being a kid and not seeing myself in these institutions when I visited Charleston, or seeing myself in a fulsome way around the city beyond the narrative of being enslaved in that particular context, as far as my ancestors. But I think that the complexity of being a Southerner is having to wrestle with these truths that continue to be relevant today by virtue of the past that we're still reckoning with.
That's interesting you say that, because I was going to ask you about that specifically in relation to Charleston. Are you able to walk around the city, drive around the city, and appreciate the beautiful parts? Or is it mostly a painful experience to be around there? What does it feel like for you when you're in the city?
It's complicated. I grew up wanting to be an architect. So I've always been enamored with homes and buildings and the structure and even the narratives behind them. And I think that at the end of the day, Charleston is home. You know, this is my home. This is a place that dates back for both sides of my family for generations. So I have as much of a stake in Charleston as anyone else. So that sense of ownership is something that I take great pride in. But the complexity comes in the fact of the pain and the horrors that have transpired, you know, for generations. You know, slavery aside, you know, there are so many generations of hardship, of pain, of injustice, you know, segregation. The disparities that continue to plague our community are seen, you know, by virtue of all these things that have happened in our past. So I think that the complicated part is being in love with your home, understanding your state because you and your ancestors built the place that you call home, but not being naive or blind to the fact that there's a cost that's still being paid by virtue of all the beauty that you see around you.
So you talked about wanting to be an architect when you were a kid, and I know you went to Divinity School at Yale. You did American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill and kind of had a big part of your study was art there. How do all those things fit together in your mind?
That's a great question. I'll say this. I think that we're all born with a greater purpose. We're born to leave the world a better place than we met it. And I think that our life's work is determining how the gifts that we were born with can be used of service in a myriad of ways. And I think for me, I've always been someone that led with passion. You know, what are the things that excite me, that inspire me, that I'm intrigued by? And how can those things be nurtured in a way to not only allow myself to grow, but to serve myself and the community? And I think another layer of that for me is a commitment to promoting and preserving African-American history and culture for the benefit of all people, but particularly for the benefit of African-Americans to have a record that can be used for inspiration, encouragement, and hope at the end of the day. So I think, you know, when I was a kid, there's something really exciting about structures and homes. I had Legos that I played with when I would build houses. And you know, my father, my parents both would actually buy me magazines of floor plans. And I would study the floor plans, how they came together, how things function and work. And I would draw, you know, them for myself. And I became really enamored with art as a form of expression, but also as a creative outlet that can lend itself to these structures that I envisioned. My aunt, Auntie Dottie, gave me a subscription to Architectural Digest in elementary school that I kept through high school. So there's a way in which everyone really encouraged this interest. And I think for me, my early, you know, exposure to art through my family was really key, because it was a way for me to understand art as an approach to historic preservation. Now, my grandfather was a artisan. He made benches and walking sticks and tables, and he actually made a desk that I have now. And so there's a way in which artistic expression for him was a way to commune with God, to actually offer a functional product for our community, but also something aesthetically pleasing that allowed me to understand that art itself has a purpose that's far greater than what we see on a wall.
When we come back, Elijah Hayward talks about a mentor who died in the Mother Emanuel shootings in Charleston, and how that event changed how Hayward sees the world. That and more ahead on Southbound. Hey y'all, if you've ever said, I want to make a podcast, well, now's your chance. WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source, is excited to announce the very first Charlotte Podcast Festival, taking place October 5th through the 30th in collaboration with the Blumenthal Performing Arts, Queen City Podcast Network, and Eclex Creative Agency. The Charlotte Podcast Festival is free and open to the public, with virtual sessions devoted to teaching attendees podcast production, marketing, monetization, and community building. If you're a podcast fan, this is a great opportunity to meet some of your favorite podcasters, like Away Messages' Jeremy Markovich, She Says' Sarah D'Elia, and The Black Guy Who Tips' Rod and Karen Morrow. And if you're already a podcaster, this is your opportunity to learn tips and tricks from folks including me. So mark your calendars, save your virtual seat, and join us at the Charlotte Podcast Festival. For more information and to RSVP, go to charlottepodcastfestival.com. And now, back to our conversation with Elijah Hayward. I wonder how much of that, what some of the things you just said were influenced by your relationship or connection with Clementa Pinckney. I know that you've spoken about that, and he was a longtime legislator in South Carolina, and he was killed in the Mother Emanuel shootings. And I just wonder what you learned from him.
I think I was far too young to really appreciate the influence, in the sense that, you know, my mother, ran a program that he was a part of. So, you know, he became, the older person, because at the time, I suspect, he's probably a teenager when I was like a kid, that I would just hear about, you know. And I think that in our town, there were not a number of younger men like him who were accomplishing amazing things. I just remember, you know, his name being far more complex to pronounce than what I could really commit to. But it stood out to me because whenever my mom said it, I knew that meant something. There's power behind it. You know, every time that he would do something, she would talk with pride about what he was able to accomplish. I remember when he became, you know, I think licensed and ordained in the AME Church, when he became one of the youngest men to join the state assembly, general assembly, when he became pastor of Mother Emmanuel. And, you know, all of the way, there was this profound example of service and giving back and ambition and education, all these values that my parents taught to inspire me to really hold a great value for. So, you know, I think even as an adult, I had a really great respect for just the service and conviction with which he lived his life. And I think that's why his death continues to be an emotional topic for me. You know, I was in Charleston the night of the shooting, and it took me a while to really process the shooting, because to me, there are few places where you feel safe. There are few places where you feel at home, or you don't have to look over your shoulder. So the fact that he and the parishioners were in a sacred place, in a place where I've always felt safe, in a place where I've spent hours on end serving in various capacities, you know, losing that sense of sanctity was tough. But even tougher was considering that someone would be murdered while they were being of service. That was really challenging for me. And not in a way of it being impossible, because I think there are examples of this throughout history, but, you know, there are few examples that you can actually touch and that you're proximate to. And, you know, as a member of my community, it really hit home in a way that made the racial violence that defined that era even more pronounced to me, in a really big way.
I want to ask about your museum in the context of other recent museums that have opened. You know, there's the National Museum of African American History and Culture in D.C. that was incredibly popular from the moment it opened its doors. There's the Legacy Museum in Montgomery, Alabama, that's also been very popular. Where does the Charleston Museum, where do you see that fitting into not just kind of museum culture in general, but the recent ones that have opened up with that African-American perspective?
Secretary Lonnie Bunch, Secretary of the Smithsonian, says that there are few museums that are actually based where the history happened. So I think that one thing that makes us particularly special is that our museum tells of a particular narrative on the site where the history happened. So standing on our grounds, you kind of feel the spirit of our ancestors. You can look out and see the path that slave ships took. You can see all these points of significance related to the American journey, American history. And I think that's something really powerful about that. The Legacy Museum has that in common with us, but I think that in a very profound way, that makes us pretty, pretty special. And I think it's really profound to consider the global significance of the African-American journey from a particularly Southern context in a city like Charleston. We are partners with the National Museum of African-American History and Culture, as well as the Legacy Museum. Both institutions have been invaluable to our journey. They have offered so much to us as we, you know, continue to work hard to refine who we are as an institution. And I think the beauty is that we hope to inspire visitors to consider this a bit of a journey that includes all of our institutions. You know, you begin in Washington, D.C., where you get a very robust and large, I will say, approach to American history through the African-American lens. You come to Charleston for a very specific discussion or discourse around this point of entry that we hope to be a point of pilgrimage for all Americans, but particularly African-Americans, because of the site of origin that Professor Henry Louis Gates talked so eloquently about. But then the Legacy Museum, it offers another discourse that connects to both, that allows for a deeper dive into the impact of racial violence in America and how Charleston, you know, I'll just say it like this. Brian Stevenson says that, you know, our museum is essential to the work of the Equal Justice Initiative, because without understanding our story, the narratives of racial violence that they explore and continue to bring to the forefront don't have proper context. So there's a way in which all of our institutions work together. But to specifically answer your question, you know, our particular value add to this landscape of international museums is that our building itself is an architectural feat designed by the late Henry Cobb to be silent, to allow for our grounds to be a place of contemplation that honors the legacy and narratives of African captives who took their first steps in America on our site. Many also who died on our site as well. So there's a way in which, you know, it's a memorial, it's a museum, but it's also a center for family history where we will be helping Americans with genealogy, but particularly African-Americans, given the limited resources available for African-Americans to do robust genealogical research.
I guess this is sort of a crass question, but part of what I wondered about these other museums opening is whether there's a competitive situation at all for historical artifacts or things like that. Is that something that's been a challenge for y'all at all?
I can't say that it is. You know, my father always says that there's enough success for everyone. So I always come from a standpoint of abundance as opposed to scarcity. And I think that the beauty is that there is a desire for people of all walks of life to be remembered, to share their stories, and to connect through objects. I think that's the beauty of my experience from Hampton University to UNC and other institutions, even Yale, is that, you know, there is an appreciation for how objects are tools for investigation, exploration to tell particular stories. So, you know, I think that it might be the complete opposite standpoint, is that there's probably an abundance of opportunity there. The only challenge is the pandemic and how it limits travel and access points at times. But, you know, I think that we're very encouraged by what's out there and how our permanent collection will come together because of all the enthusiasm we've found from people who really want to share parts of their family histories and legacies with us for preservation.
I think you brushed across this a little earlier, but I want to kind of close with this. When the museum finally opens and people start going through, and then they kind of walk out the doors maybe for the first time, What is your hope for what they take with them?
As you walk up to the museum, the building will appear to be floating. I think this is a metaphor for how we hope to elevate the African-American journey in a particular way, but also allow for our grounds to be seen as a sacred site. You look out into the Charleston Harbor, where you see the path that slave ships took. You see Sullivan's Island, where there's a Toni Morrison bench that says, that honors the fact that Toni Morrison said, nowhere in America is there a monument to enslaved people, not even a bench. So we're building this monument that really honors the heartache, the horrors, the pain, the systematic injustices that we continue to have impacts from today by virtue of child slavery. all these things are kind of at your fingertips and, you know, within eyes length as you walk our grounds. The experience of going into a museum is meant to put all this into context, to allow for visitors to have an experience that is both profound, enlightening, but also challenging, you know, to really force us to wrestle with these ideas, but not from a standpoint of limiting it to the period of slavery, but more so looking beyond slavery to origins in Africa, you know, where this Gullah Geechee distinction comes from, the community, the culture, the beauty, you know, the wealth, the artistry, all of these things, the touch point through slavery, but then the emergence beyond it for a better future that we all are living into today. Despite the challenges, it's still a far better future than my great-great-grandparents probably could imagine for us. So when you leave our museum, you walk back out into the grounds. The grounds that were designed by Walter Hood, an African-American landscape architect, that is very intent on the experience of the gardens, the African ancestors' memorial gardens being different after leaving the museum, with renewed appreciation for what you see. And that appreciation, we hope, will be one of hope, of inspiration, of believing that by understanding our past, by learning of the untold stories of the African-American journey at one of our nation's most sacred sites, visitors will be compelled to re-envision their commitment to justice in new ways.
You might have noticed how much Elijah Hayward talked about family. His aunt, who bought him a subscription to Architectural Digest. His grandfather, who built a desk that Elijah still uses. Throughout our conversation, he kept coming back to family. In this challenging summer, and of course long before now, people keep asking what Black America wants. Well, first of all, Black America is not just one thing. And second, even if it was, I'm not the proper spokesman. But if I had to put something out there, it might be this. What Black Americans want is full membership in the American family, the one that was promised in the Constitution. White Americans, by and large, have not fulfilled that promise. From the moment that Black Americans stepped off those ships in Charleston. You could read our country's entire history as an effort for groups on the outside to be welcomed and embraced, and the efforts of some on the inside to keep the doors shut. It'll be a couple of years yet, but one day the International African American Museum will open its doors. And here's hoping it'll open some minds too. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.